Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of the Bullseye Podcast brought to you by AFI Advisors. I'm your host, Josh Shores, and for this episode, I'm going to share the recording from our January 16th Lunch and Learn titled New Year, No Fear. This conversation is led by our very own Peter Raber, president of AFI. Before we dive in, I want to give a small preview of what was discussed during our Lunch and Learn. As humans, we have an extreme bias against loss. It's how we have survived as a species. The problem is, just like in life, excess fear and the inability to handle fear often leads us to missing out on the best things. The same is true for investing. During this discussion, we talk about how to deal with that fear and hopefully provide some tools to manage it going forward so we don't miss out on the best that life has to offer. We really hope that you can enjoy this recording and get something out of it. And as always, if you have any questions, please email us at connect@afiadvisors.com.
No, thank you all for coming. Thank you for your flexibility on timing. As Josh said, one of the things that we really never were able to do in the other space was bring people in and build kind of that community. And so hopefully as we move forward, we're going to be having these once every other month or so as we start. Once we get into the warmer months, there's about 1,000 square feet up above us that's a flat roof that we're going to be, you know, doing a few things up there. Even if I wanted to do it this time around, I couldn't. The decking paneling that we're putting up there is stuck in the Panama Canal with how low that water is. The boat just can't get through. So that's still on the punch list. We've still got a few things here within the office that need to get done. We got to get a lot more artwork hung up. I've got some desks that still haven't come in, but we're really excited to be here. And so going forward, one of our hopes is that this really is a community space that people can use. So we have two conference rooms. We've got the one where the food was, and then we actually have another one directly behind this. This is kind of a off this slanted wall going back. There's a conference room. That's where the bathrooms are at. Don't hesitate. If you need to go to the bathroom, need to get a drink, get more food, this is super informal. So you're not going to bother me. Similarly, if I say something and you got a question about it, don't hesitate, because I have a formal PowerPoint that I'm going to kind of use as a reference, but that's about it. Who knows what I'm going to say? And it's not live, so Josh will edit it out in the late. The picture that we put up there, Josh, you know, got me to begrudgingly to agree to, when we did all of our staff pictures. The photographer was like, well, you need to do one that's kind of a brooding face. And I was like, well, that's the best I got. Never expecting it to see the light of day. But Josh was like, well, if we're talking about fears in the market and investing, that ties up. So that may be the last time you ever see that picture. At a glance, kind of what we're doing, you know, the beginning type stuff that we have, I do want to talk about some of the most common investment fears, things that are going on in 2024 that are very specific fears, and then how working with AFI is, we hope that we're helping in that process, because one of the things that we've really kind of landed on, you know, once Josh came in and renovated kind of our outdated marketing messages is, well, what do we really want to do? And we want to make people's lives better. And so that's, where can we make people's lives better? You know, we can manage money, but ultimately, what does that mean? It's trying ultimately to make people's lives better. That is a fancy little animation. So this is one of my favorite songs. Stephen Wilson Jr. has a song called The Beginning. And we've been talking about the end ever since the beginning. It's one of my favorite songs. It really talks about the fact that we're always in these cycles of fear. And now, whether that's fear that is put out there by the media, whether that's fear that's put out there by the Mayan calendar, whether it's fear that's put out there by, you know, like Y2K, that the technology is going to rule. And now there's things like AI, where robots are going to take over the world, and we're all just going to be living in a completely different world. But this song I really like, in that we're always doing this. We're always talking about how the, you know, end is nigh. And part of that is there's money to be made, there's popularity to be gained by talking about those things, but generally not normally the case. And I tend to be a positive person, so I normally ignore it. But these are kind of major world events. I love this chart. Things that have happened since 1980, and I could have put so many more things on here, but everything on this chart, you know, had a dramatic effect. So we go Mount St. Helens in 80, we had the HIV epidemic, the Plaza Accord. For those of you who don't know what the Plaza Accord is, because that's kind of a weird one, that's where we actually agreed to devalue the US dollar because it had become so strong. It was done at a Plaza Hotel, and it's actually one of the reasons why the Japanese asset bubble, you know, was created. So there's things, you know, Chernobyl. And the reason why I go back to 1980, I was born in 1981, so it's my frame of reference. If you can take this chart all the way back, and there's always some major world event. And, you know, Y2K was going to shut all of our computers off, as I said. You know, we've just gone through COVID. We have Russia, Ukraine. We had Israel, Gaza last year. We're sitting on China, Taiwan as a major thing. We've got the election this year. But all of these things, when they come out, the initial reaction is fear. And what should I do with my money in a state of fear? And that's really where I think we can come in. So these are the most common investment fears. Losing all my money. Very rarely do we lose all of our money if we are properly invested. If you're gambling or you're speculating, yeah, you can easily lose all your money. But if you kind of Google what the most common investment fears are, losing all my money is right up there. Fear of missing out, so FOMO. So the opposite of that, we just had this the other day, in that Boeing sold off, you know, some bad news. But, you know, the next day, if you didn't buy Boeing, you know, we've rallied back about 12 points on Boeing. So I missed out on Boeing. And I go with that one very heavily in the Warren Buffett mindset. And he was talking to a whole bunch of college students. And he made the comment, if I gave everybody in the college, you know, I'm not doing this because I'm not Warren Buffett, but if I gave everybody a car, but that was the only car you were going to ever drive, you would take care of that car like it's, you know, the most important thing in the world. But it's not. You're going to miss out on things. And he equated to the fact that within the market, we always have other options. We can get in, we can get out. It's not linked to that. So the fear of missing out, I think also very heavily, if I avoid knocking my mic, deals with the fact of getting emotionally attached to particular positions. And that can be whether it's, I've got one of these. My wife inherited, at the time, First Union Bank shares from her grandfather, step-grandfather, some, you know, connection. I've never been the best with family trees. But, you know, then that became Wachovia, then it became, or it became Prudential, then it became Wachovia, now it's Wells Fargo. And we still have one share of it. It's, you know, through the splits and everything else. We'll never get rid of it, because there's an emotional attachment that I inherited that. So it's almost like that piece of jewelry that you get, you know, or some particular antique. I have an emotional attachment that has nothing to do with the market. The fact that it's one share makes it a lot easier to keep. If that was 10,000 shares and I watched the value explode and then contract, and we had the 08 banking crisis, financial crisis that would have destroyed that stock, that makes it a lot harder. And a lot of times we get locked into those positions when it really is just a line on a piece of paper type thing. This is a big one. I don't know that my light thing actually works on the screen. Let me go back. Not having enough money to retire. That one's becoming a little bit harder, in that costs have accelerated very heavily in the latter portion of life. And so, but not for everybody. We have a tremendous amount of our population who's dealing with long-term care. And do I have enough money to spend $5,000 to $15,000 a month in a assisted living type setup? Or maybe I don't. You know, so how do you plan on that massive of a difference in whether or not I need that amount of money? Will, you know, the one that used to get thrown around a lot, you don't hear quite as much anymore, although Nikki Haley has brought this back into the forefront, is will Social Security still be around when, you know, I retire? How do I want to retire? What sort of lifestyle? And those are conversations that we have with people, but they're not, there's not a math answer for everybody. Because if there was, it'd make my job a whole lot easier. But I think I've told a lot of people that, and you'll have to forgive me if I have. But like my wife's uncle has pretty heavy back problems, and he chose when he retired that he wanted to travel those first couple years of retirement at the detriment to, there was no math answer that said, yes, you should take 10% of your retirement account out per year in the first couple years of retirement. But his thought process was, this might be the only chance that I get to do XYZ. I'll deal with that afterwards, and we'll go from there. Now, his situation worked out really well that the market was up, you know, significantly those first 3 years, so it didn't impact us. But going into that and having those conversations, there's a lot of fear in there. And I'm a big geek. Most people know that, or nerd or dork or whatever word you want to associate with it. But I'm a big Harry Potter fan, and you know, Dumbledore has a quote in that, you just have to shed light on it. And so we have to have those discussions of, well, what are you really worried about? And I start a lot of meetings with the question of, well, what does this money mean to you? Trying to get to that. So having enough money to retire, and then fear of the unknown. There was an expression that came out in 2008, 2009 that I've used a lot, and it's the unknown unknown. And so we've had black swan events. That was a term that got thrown around in the media, the things that you just don't see very often. And so that black swan term comes around from the fact, well, how often do you see a black swan? If you see one, there's got to be something going on. More recently, there's a trend going around in social media, or my social media is just weird because I'm weird, talking about how many owls would you have to see in a day before you thought something was up. Like you see one owl and you're like, that's pretty cool, that's an owl. By the time you see that second owl, you're like, why have I seen so many owls, you know, type thing. So the fear of the unknown is something that drives investment decisions. And so the example would be is, I don't feel good right now about the market. I don't really know why I don't feel good about the market. I have a gut feeling or whatever it is. So I pull my money out of the market and then nothing happens. Well, if I miss a 20 point or a 20% rally, that's hard to make up. So that's one of those things that we're always kind of trying to have those conversations about when someone calls up and says, I don't want to be in the market right now. We have those conversations, well, why? And ultimately, if it's something that's happened in somebody's personal life, you know, that makes sense. I'm about to go through a divorce, or I'm about to retire, or I'm about to do XYZ. I've got a child having a wedding that I wasn't expecting, and I'm going to need to contribute. You know, those are things that we handle in the financial planning process, but just that unknown risk is something that is very heavily out there. And when we let it drive investment decisions, it almost never works out well. I'm going to pause there for a second. Are there other fears that people want me to address or talk about? Because clearly, you know, they're endless probably, but I talk a lot, so I try to take pauses. Also, we've got drinks down here. If you have a fear of becoming thirsty, there's drinks back here, and we can get a couple more. So you're exactly right. And that's, for me, sits in that fear of the unknown, in that it's unknown, and this is kind of the difference.
It's It's known,
but we don't know what. Yes. Yeah, it's a known unknown. So we have the unknown unknown. You know, Russia-Ukraine wasn't necessarily an unknown unknown, but I don't think anybody had it on their bingo card that they were going to actually invade Ukraine and still have that going on. The financial crisis being kicked off by the fact that all of a sudden there were people who realized that assets weren't worth it. We went into 2007, October, thinking, you know, we might have an asset bubble. People might be getting too many loans to do, you know, these house renovations and flipping. But I don't think we knew the extent of what we were talking about. Going into 2022, another down market year, down 20 some odd percent. Going into that year, the expectation was that the Federal Reserve might raise interest rates from functionally zero to 75 basis points. We didn't know, so we knew that there was a risk of interest rates going up. We didn't know they were going to take them up to five. So those are things that we try to handle in certain ways so that, and I do think there are things that you can do about that. And it's having those conversations about, well, if one of these unknown unknowns happened and we didn't plan on it, am I appropriately allocated up front that I can deal with that problem? And so, but you're right, government is a big one. And there's actually a slide later in the presentation that speaks to it specifically.
The other thing about the government is 2 years from right now, the whole tax structure is going to change.
Absolutely.
What's it going to do?
Right.
If it's going up, is it going to go up this way, or this way, or this way?
Right. So you got tax structure, you have the debt ceilings, another one, you have the government shutdown. So we had the government funded through the end of this month / early February. There's a deal on the table to push that out to March. But those are always the risk. The debt ceiling to me is the one that we always run into of kind of there's consensus that we have to raise the debt ceiling. There's consensus that we shouldn't be in a position where we have to raise the debt ceiling. But it's always a last minute thing, and that conversation drives the markets crazy. And those fears, this is something that I like a lot. So this goes back for 20 years, so through 1999. So if you stayed fully invested with $10,000 in the S&P 500, that's what this chart is referencing. If you just had the S&P 500, didn't buy or sell anything else, if you did that, you averaged 5.6% over that time period for a 20-year time period. Now, that number has come way down. Now, part of that is because it goes through 2018. So we're missing, you know, the rallies that continued on, you know, through 2021. But just missing the best days of the year can have massive. So we come down here, missed 60 of the best days. You actually had a negative 7.4% return during that time period just by missing the best days. So I would throw my brother in this bus, and love Donnie to death. But, you know, he's got some concerns about what's going on in the election. So he's pulled back his amount. And that's not necessarily wrong, but I worry that we might miss out on a rally. And if those things don't come to pass, then where are we at? If you'll remember going into the President Trump, Hillary Clinton election, the expectation going into that was that if either candidate won, because at that time, you know, we didn't really know what sort of President Trump would be, and people knew what Hillary would be. So the expectation was that in both scenarios, the market was going to be down. The market rallied straight out the gate and really didn't stop until we hit COVID. But there was an expectation that if because he was such a wild card, if President Trump won, we might be down 10 to 15%. So if everybody says we're going to be down 10 to 15%, why wouldn't I go to cash right before the election? And this is why. Because we don't know. Even with our very murky crystal balls, we miss them. And it is a roller coaster. So this has a lot of different things, but this I think is pretty accurate about how people feel, especially about individual stocks, or if you're just going into the market. It's like, I see a trend. I'll wait to see if they're profitable. It didn't move. I'm glad I didn't buy that. I decided to buy it. oh, wow, at this price, I'm going to double my position. And then it comes all the way down here. Lucky I sold everything, and then we get back up. And so this is that emotional roller coaster that we go on. And the more we can remove ourselves from it, the better our long-term results are. But everybody who's been invested for any period of time has some version of this. I bought an oil and gas stock, and then all of a sudden, you know, the Middle East decides that they're going to dramatically increase production when there was no signs of it. Oh, well, you know, I'm going to keep on doing that and double my position. And we get, oh, now all of a sudden Russia, Ukraine happens and, you know, it skyrockets back up. Russia, you know, oil's now come back down. We're at 255 at the pump. You know, those stocks have come back down. So that roller coaster, we try to eliminate as much as possible, but unless you just don't watch it, there's not a lot of ways to avoid it. So this could apply to individual stocks or could, you know, apply to precious metals. Gold has gone through this same thing. Stocks go through it. It's pretty common, you know, roller coaster. This is what I'm looking at for 2024. These are kind of the headline fears. So you got Israel, Gaza. Big part of that, oil and gas prices. If somehow that boils over and turns into a much wider spread war in the Middle East, then obviously oil and gas prices are going up. Russia, Ukraine, there seems to be no end in sight there. And if there is, it might be one of those things that all of a sudden it's just done. It's hard to believe that, but it could be, or it could last another 5 years. Well, how do you, you know, measure that impact? China collapse. So the next year, China. So we've seen Chinese real estate dramatically fall off. And a lot of it is driven by how their government policies work. And for the longest time, we keep seeing, you know, whether it's their real estate, whether it's, we're starting to actually pull some manufacturing out of there. So there's a industrial park in Mexico now that is, they've got about 20, 30 different manufacturing companies that are moving their production from China to Mexico with the thought process that, well, that will enable me to be able to evade the regulations. But coming up until the last, what, maybe 2-3 years, China was on its pace to replace the US dollar, and it was going to, you know, completely wipe out our place as a reserve currency. And now we're flipping on that, which leads us to China, Taiwan. I've got real big concerns about China, Taiwan because of what's going on in the collapse. So one of the easiest ways when you're a dominant power to take attention off the fact that your economy is not doing that well is to start a war. And so China, Taiwan, all the warning signs are there. The problem is we just don't know when, how, what, and because of the US's agreements, we've got a lot more at stake about getting drawn into that than we did with Ukraine. But if it doesn't happen, so if this was your only fear coming into this year, one, good for you, but two, if we pulled out of the market because of it, then we struggle. Inflation, inflation continues to be there. And inflation is one of those ones that I've spent a lot of time talking about lately because I think the media does a very poor job of explaining inflation. And so they'll come out there and say, inflation is falling. And then people go to the grocery store and they're like, I'm paying more. There's a disconnect. And so, but the rate in which it is going higher is falling. So, you know, your, you know, dozen eggs that have gone up $2 in the last 2 years, maybe they're going up another 10 cents, but they're not going up another dollar instead. So, and one of the things with inflation is we got very used to no inflation. And if you go back to 1980 to today, there's been roughly 3% annualized inflation. We just happened to get a lot of it in a two-year period. You know, so if you go back like 2014, 2015, there's virtually no inflation. And so people got very used to the fact that there was no inflation. So when it hits all at once and it's one of these shocks, that's a big problem. And so I do think also within inflation, so when people, I guess, talk about inflation, I say inflation is becoming less of a problem. It's for the market, not for your pocketbook. There's been a tremendous amount of corporate inflation and corporate profits that have increased as well. So they've gotten used to the fact that, well, we've got a consumer paying X. Why would I drop my price if I don't have competition from someone else? And if the consumers are used to prices being up there, it's going to be hard. Real estate bubble, thought process is that mortgage rates at 8%, we've got to see real estate implode. Sorry, real estate, you know, it is what it is. What we're actually seeing is quite the opposite. So there's roughly 86, 87 million homes that are households that own a home in the United States. 40 some odd percent of that have zero debt. And a significant portion of that remaining 60 have fixed long-term rates at 3-4%. So it's those marginal buyers that, and I think we've gotten hit with it so hard here, so it's a conversation we have. You know, if someone sold their $1 million home in California and comes here and buys a $300,000 home, pays cash and has, you know, money in the bank, easy for them. But if you already live here and, okay, I can sell my home for $300,000, but what I can buy for $300,000 in my downsizing phase is I'm getting worse than what I have. So what I do think you'll have is a slowing. But we still have a tremendous amount of demand and we have a supply problem. So I don't see the bubble bursting quite as bad. Plus, we've got interest rates potentially coming down this year, which will take some of that pressure off. Depending on who you are in the market, we've seen anywhere from 3 to 6 rate cuts being predicted for 2024. So I think I don't see the 6, I really don't. 6 would be we're into a recession. 3 would be we're kind of trying to right size and manage the soft landing that they keep talking about, but it's out there. So that's not actually a risk that I'm nearly as concerned about. U.S. deficits, I talk about this one at least once or twice a day. Deficits keep coming up. If it was my checkbook, how could I possibly, you know, live this way? We do have the benefit of being the reserve currency of the world, China being the potential replacement falling off, and Europe and the euro, they're not there as replacement currencies. So we do benefit from that. Long term, it is absolutely a problem. We actually haven't peaked yet on the amount of annual deficit compared to like 1991. 1991, we had way more compared to the GDP than what we have now, but it is a problem. And we've been up here in the ratios before. So if you go back, you know, debt to GDP, roughly 120%. We've been up here before and we've come back down, you know, into the 40s, 50s. We need GDP to increase for that to happen. But we've done it before. Part of that, you know, was the war spending that came in and everything else, and we ramped up and came out of the Great Depression. But we have been here before. It's not unique to this time. Long term, it has to get solved in some form or fashion. Otherwise, this fear becomes a much more realistic one. The problem is we can't allow it to affect our decisions for necessarily this year, which a lot of people, you know, are doing. Recession, I don't see a recession this year. Goldman has the odds at 30%. That's up from their base of every single year at 15%. You have certain people who have us at 70, 80% chance of recession. I don't necessarily see a recession this year, partially because people are still employed. Unemployment, and there's 1,000 problems with the way they measure it, but unemployment's low. And as long as people are employed, consumers will continue to spend, consumers being the biggest part of our economy. It is what it is. I just don't see it happening this year. Now, that doesn't mean next year's not on the table. Corporations still have tons of money on their balance sheets, so they have room to take some hits in a slowdown before they start reducing workforce. One would hope that they would choose to take the hit there before they reduced workforce, but you know, that's not how people are compensated. This is the big one. So S&P changed by presidential term. The market doesn't care who the president is. It just doesn't. Individual stocks very much care who the president is. So if you are someone who depends on regulations being a certain way, it makes a big difference. You know, so clearly environmental regulation coming in and hurting a company, if the Democrats are in power, that's going to hurt, you know, those type companies. Flip side, you know, take regulation away, whether it's in banking or in energy, that's going to take it away. But if we go back and look at it, the only time we've been negative, you've got Nixon, Ford, and you've got Bush Jr. 1 and 2. You know, and in there you've got, you know, the war in Iraq. So it doesn't really matter who the president is for it to be a positive market. Now, you can make an argument that a particular president or a particular political party would be better for my individual portfolio, and I will give that to you all day long. But the market in general doesn't care. If we pulled this down and looked at Biden through today, it's roughly 53% when you include dividends. 52 if you don't. And so this chart didn't distinguish whether dividends were included, but I'm pretty sure they were based upon the article that was written. But in general, we don't see it. And actually, if you go back, you know, both the Clinton and Obama years, we had outsized markets. You could make the argument that they're benefiting by the policies that the Republicans put in right before them. You could make the argument that they changed things. I don't really get into it. I try very heavily when I'm talking with people to take politics out of it. I don't think it's something that matters from a long term, because I'm a believer in America. I believe America will grow. And if America grows, the S&P grows, and we keep going. But this is the big one. Now, what this doesn't talk about is the volatility. And that's, I think, where this year in particular, you're going to have a tremendous amount of volatility. So if we look at first couple months, you know, we've been positive. We're up about 2% year to date here in January. You get maybe another couple months before, you know, once we get through primary season, we'll see where it goes. Back half of this year is just going to be volatile as all get out. And what that will be is the individual stocks and the big corporate algorithms and everything else making adjustments based upon who they think will be. So it wouldn't surprise me if we're up, you know, at the end of the year, 6%, 7%. But throughout that year, we've had 20% swings in either direction. So that volatility, which is normally what, if we go back a little bit onto this one, okay, well, when we're having those 20-point swings, where do I buy and where do I sell? And that's normally the problem, is that we're very bad as investors in general all across the world at picking when those time periods are. And this volatility will be very heavy. I do think, you know, personal opinion, I think that there's money on the sidelines to do it. And that's, if we get a rally, that'll be where we go. And that money will come in. So this is kind of, the Vanguard did a study, and I'll talk a little bit about this. Where do we find people like Aldebaran or other advisors? How are we providing value? Typically, we add roughly 3% per year in value, alpha in returns. It's very rarely 3% in a particular year. It might be that in the year that the market dropped 15%, your account was down 10, you know, that type thing. So, but where does that come from? Asset allocations, number one, roughly 80%.
Is that inflation adjusted or is that just
raw numbers? Raw numbers, point to point. So if you had, you know, and the way they come up with that number is there's studies out there of how investors who do it completely on their own do versus investors who do, you know, work with an advisor. And it's just point to point. And in general, it comes from various places. Number one is asset allocation, and roughly 80% of your overall return is driven by asset allocation, stocks to bonds, and getting that right. They actually don't give you much credit. They know it's somewhere between 0 and 2%, you know, comes out of that. But the fact that if you're in retirement and you're in 100% stocks, that's not asset allocation, you know, wise. An advisor, you know, comes in there. So that helps. Cost effectiveness. This is a huge one for firms that use a lot of mutual funds. And so you could be in two identical mutual funds. And a lot of times we'll see this in that when we look at a portfolio that we're bringing in, they'll be in a whole bunch of mutual funds that are charging very high expense ratios. And you never see that number come out of your portfolio. So let's say a fund has a 1.5% expense ratio, your performance is just less 1.5%. So you never functionally pay that. You know, it's not an out-of-pocket expense, but there might be another fund that does the exact same thing that charges 1% or only 10 basis points or whatever it is. And advisors, we're charged by the SEC if we use funds to find the lowest cost funds. And sometimes it's the exact same fund, there's just another version of it. Brian did a huge project where we had a number that we were looking at that just by buying the right fund, you'd save about 30 basis points on that particular fund, just buying the right fund share. Rebalancing, they say that gives roughly 15 basis points. So that's where we have these periods of time where the market runs and all of a sudden, you know, my 60-40 portfolio became an 80-20. By rebalancing that back to the 60-40 kind of consistently, over time, you know, if I was intended to be in something that wasn't that risky, it saves. Behavioral coaching, that's kind of what we've talked about this whole time, keeping people invested in the plan. Tax efficient strategies. So this would be, you know, avoiding capital gains where we can. And that's a huge part of what we do. You know, when someone comes to us and says, hey, I need to raise $10,000 because my daughter's going to college and I need to make that payment that we had talked about and planned about. Well, if I sell Apple and I take $8,000 worth of capital gain, that's a lot different than selling something that has no, you know, capital gain. Withdrawal strategies are in that same boat for taxes. You know, where are we pulling the money out of when we need it so that we're not getting clipped on taxes? And total return versus income. Total return versus income, a lot of times, you know, if we're looking at something that just has a high payout ratio, and I'll throw like Verizon or AT&T into this group, you know, if it's paying us 5-7%, we look at the dividend, we're like, that's great. But if the underlying capital is dropping, total return wise, we're down. And so looking at things from a perspective of, well, what's the total return going to be? Not just how much is my cash flow. So these are kind of all those things put together. My favorite thing on here is best action might be no action, which is really hard to say because if someone's, you know, paying me to manage their money and I tell them they shouldn't do anything, well, that doesn't sound, you know, but functionally that might be the best thing. Preparing for the unexpected, knowing up front where we're at. And then this is just something that I like to throw out there. This is by month what the investment returns are. So in theory, you could sell every February, sell every May, and sell every September and only have positive investments your entire life. But most months are up, tend to be up across the broad market. We don't feel that way, especially when we have prolonged periods of time. You know, 2007 to the base in 2009, you'd be hard-pressed to find a positive. You know, we had some big rallies during that time period, but you know, we were at 14,400 on the Dow, and we bottomed out at 6,600 in March of 2009. Well, that was most of these months included in there, but it's something that over that long term, when we go back and look at it, the people who were able to sustain their investments over that time period were the ones that by 2010, 2011, 2012 had more than made back up their you know, portfolio, and then we're in the market to go higher. So if you had sold out in mid-2008, but then didn't get back into the market until 2011. You missed out kind of on that, you know, chart that we were looking at earlier. So that's actually, I'll go back one. So I'm going to pause there. That's the formal remarks that I wanted to go through. I think it's really important to know what's driving those fears so that we can make the right allocations.